You are listening to Fantha Tracks.
Because of the following special program, Wonder Woman and the Incredible Hulk will not be presented this evening.
Time to get all your Star Wars news in a single file. This is Making Tracks. Here are your hosts, Mark Newbold and Mark Mulcaster.
It's not true.
Hello and welcome to episode 185 of Making Tracks, brought to you by those fine folk over at fanfortracks.com. My name's Mark. I am one of your pilots on our journey round the Star Wars galaxy. And my big, hairy co-pilot is, of course, none other than Mr. Mark Newbold. Mark, how you doing, buddy? How's things?
It's good. I would have been less hairy if I'd got to the hairdressers this morning as I planned to get my hair cut. So,
nice bit of volume there on the old Barney.
Yeah, thank you.
How's things, dude? So how's your week in Star Wars been?
I think now we're coming out of January, we're heading into February, we're starting to sort of plot and plan. I know you certainly are with your work with the Rebel Legion, but sort of starting to plot and plan for events and stuff that's coming up and looking ahead already, looking to the summer for LFCC and Star Wars Fan Fun Day and all those kind of events. So, yeah, we're doing good. How about you, mate?
And she took the time to pop down to Russell Square in London, and I went to what is quite proudly promoted as London's oldest film fair, put on by the lovely people over at Showmasters. So I went there, had a mooch around, met a couple of Star Wars and James Bond faces, shall we say, names and faces, got some stuff signed and made my merry way back, which was quite nice. It was a kind of a whistle-stop tour of London, in and out, very surgical. So I think I was quite impressed with that because I didn't kind of spend much. I didn't hang around much either, which is, you know, makes a change because, you know, when we do these conventions sometimes, we're there for hours.
I'm sure you get the same. I have people, whenever I go to an event, they say, oh, you're off on your holidays again. And I'm like, I wish it was a bloody holiday. You know, up early and you're on your feet all day and then you're socialising at night, which is fun, but it's still a long day. I'm not complaining. I wouldn't change it. But yeah, it's certainly no holiday. This week, have you had anything new come into your collection, Mr. Mulcaster?
No. I did go down, like I said, I did go down to London Film Fair. There were some items that I wanted, but I couldn't find them. But I did come up with a couple of contacts for dealers who were like, we might have that, just not here. So we will get back to you. I'm heading to Greece with a band this weekend, so I'll keep my eye out for any Star Wars bits and bobs out there. You'll be surprised what random stuff you kind of find when you're on your travels with a band. So if I see something, I'll pick it up. If it's not for me, I'll pick it up for you. How about yourself? What about you? What did you get?
Well, one thing I can mention is I do have a spare copy of Dawn of the Jedi, if you're in the market for such a thing. So
I am, sir. Yes, we talked about this last week. Yes, I will very much gracefully take it off your hands. Don't you worry.
Fantastic. I got nothing much this week. I've been sorting the room out, putting bits away and having a bit of a tidy around. I had some of the latest hoodies and caps from Roosevelt come through. So I'm very, very pleased with those. But I did get this. It's researched and edited by Cara DJ. It's Star Wars Woodstock. It's a historic timeline of the first Star Wars celebration. So Dan Madsen, who was instrumental along with Steve Sansweet and some of the other Lucasfilm folks in getting celebrations started back in 1999 in Denver to celebrate Phantom Menace. Yeah. He posted about this on his timeline, but I thought, I'm going to take a little punt on this. I'm going to order this. It's not the sort of thing I would normally get these days, back in the day, definitely, but not so much now. And I'm so glad I did because Cara sent it through and it is, in a word, delightful. It's completely fan put together. It's proper old school, scrapbooky, handwritten, you know, from her point of view, going through the whole event, day one, day two, day three, of course, on the Sunday. It's just absolutely gorgeous. Some well-chosen photographs and just a little look at what happened at that celebration. I haven't read it cover to cover yet. I'm very much looking forward to putting some time aside with a cup of tea and having a good go through it. Yeah, I think I might just be subscribing to this fanzine because it's been a long time since I've actually had a physical in-hand fanzine.
Yeah.
And I kind of missed it.
Yeah, I was going to say it's kind of like a lost art and something very much of like a bygone era when you think about it. Nowadays, everybody is vlogging and blogging and posting on social media and stuff. It's very rare to join A, a fan club these days, and B, you know, actually have a physical newsletter, which is really cool. So having like a fanzine like that, it's kind of like unique. So I hope it does well, and I hope that she continues to put some out, because, I mean, the actual topic sounds great. I mean, for me, I didn't really even hear much about like Star Celebration was until, maybe four, I think, or five. And at that point, it was through probably the Force cast, by which point it had been and gone. And so, the first one for me was the first like London Celebration.
Same.
But from what I had heard, the first Celebration was almost a military operation, just partly because it was flooded, wasn't it, pretty much? You should do a little review on the site if you haven't done one already, once you've had a chance to kind of like nip through it.
That is totally the plan. It's charming. She's put a little sticker in, and there's a trading card and just a little note saying thanks for the interest. There will be a review of this on the site over the next week or two.
Brilliant. So what are we going to talk about today?
Daisy Ridley. There's been loads of posts about Daisy lately. She's been talking to lots of different outlets because she's got a lot of work on the go, a lot of films and projects on the go. But of course, every time she talks to somebody, they can't not ask her about Star Wars, of course, because she is, as we know, coming back for what we keep calling Episode 10. It won't be called Episode 10, I don't imagine. In this interview with Inverse, she talks about her latest film roles and then nips back to the era of when she got the role, when she was much, much younger. She kind of, it's kind of almost funny because she barely looks any different. And yet she talks about herself like she was a toddler at the time. I guess in acting terms, maybe she was. But the role really did, not just mentally and not just professionally, but physically, take a toll on her. She says, she mentions it in the piece, I'll read it. Ridley, for example, has been open in the past about living with both endometriosis and polycystic ovary syndrome, which are two extremely common disorders that afflict women, and skin problems she's experienced as a result. She's spoken about the toll that stress and exhaustion took on her after The Force Awakens hit theatres, and by the time The Last Jedi opened, Ridley's anxiety was so severe, she developed holes in her stomach wall, which can be very dangerous. She mentioned slowing down and then the pandemic and Rise of Skywalker and all the other stuff. So she really was in the wars. And I just wonder your thoughts on this. You know, a young actor or actress gets a massive role. And JJ says it's a life-changing thing. You're not just going into any old film. This is a film that's treated like a religion by some people. Let's not pretend it's any other way with Star Wars. So she's walking into a battlefield that she's got no experience with. The stress and the pressure that probably she puts on herself to a degree really did hit her hard. You step forward to now, 2024. She's 10 years older plus. By the time the next film comes out, we'd like to think it will be within the next 18 months to 2 years, maybe, give or take. You know, it depends on when they get started. Do you think she's doing the right thing by putting herself back in the firing line? Do you think that given her experiences on social media, that she's been able to push away from that a little bit and can come into it with an older head?
Yeah, I mean, I think this time around, she's probably got a better understanding of what she's kind of letting herself in for, the anticipation and the hype behind The Force Awakens. It very much was like trying to run alongside a roller coaster and jump on it whilst it's moving. It was kind of different for Mark and Harrison and Carrie back in the day because they were going along with the success. So the success happened with Star Wars. So not only was it successful and they were taken back, I think the public was taken back and didn't quite know really what Star Wars was in the same respects. Now, you know, 40 years on, everybody in 2014 and 2015 was hit over the head with like nostalgia, like this is what you are meant to feel when you watch Star Wars, and this is what you're going to feel when you watch the new Force Awakens, and look at our amazing new cast, aren't they lovely, you're going to love them. You know, you've kind of basically been, I wouldn't say hung out to dry as such, but you're definitely out on a limb, you know, and ultimately if a film is successful or if it fails, you know, you're in the firing line, and that's what we saw, especially like 10 years ago. Social media was becoming that ugly monster that it now is, and the proliferation of Facebook, Twitter and Instagram and everything else which came in between, Vine and all the other bits and bobs, that all adds up. And you know, suddenly being thrust into that public spotlight, as well as having to perform on a day-to-day basis, you know, in the role and train, because I mean, those videos that we saw of Rise of Skywalker, this behind the scenes videos of Daisy training, Matt, it was up there with the intensity of, you know, Hayden and Ewan in the prequels. I think fair play to her. I think it's great and highly commendable that she's kind of come up and said, look, this is taking a toll and stuff. And also when you go back, and I mean, I saw this article for the first two films, she was paid $270,000 to $325,000 for each film, which is a lot of money. However, you think about now, she's been reported to maybe be earning somewhere in between like $12 and $13 million. So the fact of the matter is, not only must she have the confidence of being able to come back and deliver, but the studio must have the same confidence to be able to kind of write, say, right, we write this check for you because we believe in you. And so that in itself has got to make her feel a little bit more comfortable that she could helm this ship and she's prepared mentally and physically to be able to do it.
I suppose when Force Awakens came out, it's a massive difference. I suppose you can grade down the cast, and I suppose you can on most films and certainly any sequel, if there's a returning actor. But if you're in Star Wars and you've got the Holy Trinity coming back in The Force Awakens, that's like mega level insane interest. No wonder the film did as crazy well as it did. And then you have your new cast, and then you have the characters and parts like a Boba Fett type character. You know, those kind of characters. Not that they were in the sequel trilogy, but you know what I mean? You always get these sort of gradients of characters in Star Wars films. And Daisy comes in as the big new character and the interest that comes with it. And Daisy's the focal point. She's the girl on the posters. And, you know, we know that she's the one that we're following. You go into this new film now and you mention the money. Of course, Daisy Ridley's not going to earn a fraction of what Harrison Ford earned because he's Harrison Ford and he's made billions. There's only Samuel L. Jackson made more money at the cinema history than him. So, of course, he's going to make more money. And now she goes from earning that small amount, which no doubt it was, to her profile's raised. She gets other roles and you get to episode 9 and she obviously earned more for episode 9. And now, as you say, comes back on a hefty pay package. My long-winded point is that she is now kind of where, in relation to this bunch of films, she's where Harrison, Mark and Carrie were when they came into The Force Awakens. I know she's much, much, much younger. We could have an 18-year-old come into this new film in a race, I'm waggling the air quotes, race-style character. And Daisy, as Rey, is now in her 30s, much further on down the line as a character and as an actress. And so you've kind of got that dynamic sort of replicated again, and she's got all that heft behind her. So what I'm thinking is now she's very much put this out there. We're talking about it. Other podcasts, other websites, other organisations will talk about the fact that doing this, it was tough. I mean, like in any job, whatever job, you know, I have crap days, you have crap days. It's a job. This job really whooped it out of her. She's put it out there. So do you think, maybe not an overt way, but do you think perhaps Lucasfilm are listening, thinking, we need to make sure this doesn't happen to Daisy again? Or do you think things like this are just beyond anybody's control? Because if you could protect somebody against it, you would, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Is it fair to say that in some respects, these stars are earning the money because they are out there? And so you could almost say that there's a certain level of danger money attached to the role, because if they're helming this foray into the future for Star Wars, then, you know, she's going to be ultimately connected forever in the same way that it doesn't matter really what any of those other actors have done, Mark, Carrie and Harrison, they will forever be associated with Star Wars. Star Wars actor Mark Hamill, Star Wars actor Carrie Fisher. You know, that's how things get reported and connected, and that's how people become household names. And as you get more successful, obviously the risks get higher. But then also, I think the confidence to be able to land those jobs and to make sure that, you know, it's executed well, there's more confidence there. Sure, you're going to stick your neck out for big jobs. However, you're going to know through experience how to deal better with a fan reaction, if it's positive or if it's negative, or if it's really negative. And I'm sure she's learned over the years in probably the hardest way possible, just to switch off. You know, she came off social media and, you know, she just ignores patrols, and that's a great way of doing it. It's not something you can learn other than by doing it and experiencing it, you know, which makes it really tough.
When those three films came out before, certainly on Force Awakens, you saw Harrison on the press tour, on the PR push, and Carrie, of course.
Yeah.
And Mark, very much so. Daisy and Boyega, John and Oscar Isaac, to a slightly less degree, we're out there as well. Now you come back all these years later, 10 years next year since Force Awakens came out, and Daisy will be the marquee name. Do you think that she'll be out there? I can't imagine that she wouldn't be, but, you know, she'll be the one out there telling stories of, hey, when I worked with Carrie Fisher on Force Awakens and Last Jedi, you know, those kind of things. It's another level of maturity, if you like, in the role and as an actress. So do you think she will shy away from wanting to do that PR push, or do you think she'll be right?
No,
in the
No, I think she'll be right in the thick of it. I think she'll be pushed. You know, she'll do all the late night shows in America, Matt, and Graham Norton over here and everything else in between, you know, from like This Morning to Loose Women to BBC Breakfast. You know, that's how it is. Get pushed. You learn, don't you? We've both been interviewed on numerous occasions for the BBC or other web outlets and the press and stuff. And the more you do, the more you kind of become a bit savvy to it. And we don't have, as it were, quote unquote, media training, whereas they have a little bit more handholding, at least to begin with. But also, one of the biggest complaints, you know, we heard a lot through that sequel trilogy was about, oh, she's overpowered, she's Mary Sue, blah, 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 and all this nonsense, which I think both me and you definitely disagree with. People have come to live, as it were, and should have accepted Rey in the Star Wars galaxy. So you would like to hope that whatever they do with Rey in this new film, all that stuff has gone away, because we would hope that we're going to see her in the height of her powers and she's going to be still in her prime, still kicking ass. So hopefully they're going to be able to do something which is going to be even more fantastic and slightly out of the box and really maybe push for Jedi and what they are in a different direction. But you'd kind of think that evolution of how she got from Rey from nowhere on Jakku to where she is now, that will, I think, have been bedded into the lore, into the expanded universe, and it's going to just feel a little bit more like, oh, we're picking up a Rey story, how fantastic, rather than trying to kind of size her up and work out who she is and what she's actually doing on our screen.
For everything in one location, daily news, reviews, interviews, podcasts, video and social media feeds, bookmark FanthaTracks.com for Star Wars news 24/7, 365.
Good news if you're a Jurassic Park or Jurassic World fan. They are doing more movies. They will be written by David Koepp, who worked on Jurassic and Indiana Jones. Steven Spielberg will produce for Amblin. Frank Marshall's back on board producing. Probably ILM doing the visuals and Skywalker Sound doing the audio and all the other Star Wars connections that come with a Jurassic film. It's only a couple of years since Jurassic World Dominion came out, and it's looking like we could have a new Jurassic film, maybe within 12 to 18 months. All good news if you like those films, which I do very, very much. But my question, because this is a Star Wars podcast, isn't just the connections between Jurassic and Star Wars, because there are many, many, many. But do you think, Mark, there can be too many sequels or prequels? We live in a world, Star Wars, there's sequels and prequels and equals and all the other calls that you could possibly want. And we want more of it because it's a world, it's a fully rounded world, and you can dip into all sorts of corners of Star Wars and tell numerous stories. Goodness knows there's books and comics and everything coming out every week. So Star Wars maybe is slightly different, but the amount of times people say, who asked for this, who wants this, we've seen it with Jurassic, where people are saying, really, do we need more Jurassic films? And the last three movies all made $1 billion. I'm pretty sure Universal and the shareholders are very happy for there to be more Jurassic films. But do you think sometimes there can be too many sequels? And I asked that to a James Bond fan. There's how many James Bond films? Do you think you can go to the well too many times? Maybe that's the better way of putting it.
Well, you can. You know, if we look at just other random properties, and I'm going to say Predator, right? And especially Predator. If they had never made another Predator film after Arnie got in the chopper, I think I would have been a happy man, because that film did exactly what it needed to do in the tin and no more. That's kind of like late 80s. We're still in the world of the sequels, so they have to make a second one. And it had Danny Glover in it, and it just wasn't very good. I think it comes down to, does the actual initial premise support multiple iterations and multiple attempts to make a new franchise? Because that's basically what it is. Everybody wants a franchise, and I've said this loads. It's we are living in the world of a franchise at the moment. There was a bit of a backlash in the box office, but with films like Oppenheimer and Barbie, which are standalone, and we knew that really there's never going to be an Oppenheimer 2, and we need that. I saw the opus that is The Beekeeper with Jason Statham. That's the kind of film that quite easy to do a sequel to. It's quite formulaic anyway. The whole kind of concept is very much man on a mission, kicking ass. Simple, you know, basically you point him at something else, some other blight on society, and he'll go and, I guess, beekeep the hell out of that. But then something like Jurassic World and Jurassic Park, it's difficult because I think even the original films, after about the second one, I think they lost their way a little bit. Jurassic World, that I think had a slightly better world building philosophy, which made it a little bit easier to kind of make these sequels. But it kind of felt like we were done at that point. Now, I only seen it once or twice, but I mean, I'm assuming that they didn't manage to catch all the dinosaurs, and whether or not that means that actually they've now created a second phase, shall we say, of Jurassic World, and where all the dinosaurs are going to roam around and stuff like that. And, you know, that's where your peril is and that's where your conflict is actually how do you live in a world with humans and dinosaurs trying to coexist? That's, I guess, where the story is. So that could work. But I mean, there are some films. Solo, everybody was saying about Solo, it's not the film that we need. And it's like, well, most stories we don't necessarily need, but sure, they're there for entertainment. And so it's like, is it entertaining us for a couple of hours? Is it actually something that we can disconnect from the real world and just sit down and enjoy and not bother checking our phone? And I think that's the key, because ultimately all these film companies are owned by big corporations who are only interested really in the dividends that they're making from their shares. Therefore, they will always want to make new films. And I think it's kind of the challenge of the creatives to then come up with a new and interesting story to justify that.
When Star Wars came out, one of the benchmark films that it was compared to was Planet of the Apes. Fox were thinking their other big franchise was Planet of the Apes. And if Star Wars can do as well as Planet of the Apes, which even by then was starting to drop into sort of TV movie level, it would be doing okay. And of course, yeah, it made more than all the monkey films put together. So big hit. You come to 2024, we have Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes coming out. When you've had a trilogy of apes movies, as good as those three were, then they announce a new one. And you look at it and realize, wow, we've stepped forward. We're moving towards the original Planet of the Apes era now, where the apes are in charge and the humans are on the run. And all of a sudden, I couldn't outwatch that trailer, apart from thinking technically it looks amazing and those films have been uniformly good. What a clever thing to do. What a very valid sequel. Because now they've not just done what the Tim Burton, not to knock Tim Burton, but you know, the Tim Burton Planet of the Apes back in 2001 was fine, but it was a straight-up remake of the original and not pretty as much, good or effective as the original. But now you've come along and you've had this grounding of this original trilogy of modern Planet of the Apes films. And now they're getting into that world that we knew so well from the original. Was it 68, 69 when the first Planet of the Apes?
68, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they've really thought that through and quite possibly set up another trilogy. That feels like a very, very valid sequel. And you just mentioned the hypothesis of where they could take Jurassic going forward in the future. And they hinted at it in the last couple of films of sort of human DNA getting worked in and different creatures and what they put in the Indominus Rex so it can cloak itself in Jurassic World and all the other stuff that they did. And when that film came out, not quite to the same degree, but not that far away, it was almost as big a hit as Force Awakens, bringing back an old franchise. And so I think sometimes you can go to the well too much.
Like, this is where, say, personally, I think MCU kind of struggled, is that you kind of felt like you had a clear and definite like line drawn at the end of Endgame. That's it. The world and the galaxy, in fact, everywhere, the universe has been saved. Yeah. So therefore, you know, everybody lives happily ever after. Now, we know that's not the same because, like, you know, the next issue of Iron Man comes out by Marvel next week. And it's like, you know, he's back kicking ass, because that's when you kind of feel like, okay, you've had a franchise and now you're almost trying, like a Night Sister, to kind of reanimate it a little bit. And it's these zombie franchises, which have basically been dead for almost a long time. That's where we're at with Star Wars. Yeah. I think sometimes with Star Wars, when they try and fit stuff in the past, so in that time period between the rise of the Empire and like eventual destruction, it kind of feels a little bit more shoehorned. But the stuff going forward with, say, The Mandalorian and with Rey, that feels a little bit more natural, even though we know there's still a end game in the Mandoverse, because we know that it ends with the start of the sequel trilogy. That's a 35-year time gap. So that's a hell of a lot of time to tell different stories and introduce different characters.
The only thing, though, with Star Wars, that there's never been a point, maybe at the end of A New Hope, if it hadn't made enough money and they didn't do Empire, yeah, and they made that crappy TV movie version of Something in the Mind's Eye, whatever they did, and they didn't do any more, we'd still be talking about Star Wars. We'd still think of it fondly, no doubt. We'd look back
and
that was a great film from our childhood. But there's never been a moment, really, outside of George saying, I need a break, where the fandom has gone, right, enough, we don't need anymore. There's no desire for anymore. It's such a rich world. It's such an involved environment that even if you're not telling stories about Luke and Leia, you'd want to know what the Rebellion is doing or what the Underworld is doing. There's never been a line drawn in the sand. You make a great point about Endgame. I think Marvel probably now and Disney would look back and go, you know, maybe we should have just left it for 3 years. and come back to it. And now we're just getting into phase four rather than being where we are. And understandably, the business, you know, Disney Plus takes off and it does so well. And Star Wars has never had that line drawn in the sand, really, has it? There's always been the desire for more.
Yeah, there always has been. And I think it's, I suppose you say, almost like there's a difference, right? Star Wars created, I think, really what we consider like a fandom. And whilst there were others like Star Trek and, like I said, James Bond, about the first big business fandom. I mean, I think there was an ad was published in like 1983 or something, which listed all the licensees for Lucasfilm. And it kind of said already earned like $2 billion in merchandising. And that's in 1983. But the thing is, there's so many different pop culture, kind of genre, franchisey things. People are, I think, a little bit more attuned to hopping on one and then binging it. And I suppose you almost say like mainlining it for its period where it's in vogue. And then they happily hop onto something else. And they happily hop onto like another thing. And then obviously when a good Marvel film comes back or something, they kind of then jump back onto it. You do see with Star Wars that fans are consistently there. Like, you've been consistently there since like 1980, and I've been consistently there since like 91. And that doesn't necessarily mean that every week we watch Star Wars or every week we do something to do with Star Wars, although nowadays every week we talk about Star Wars and every week we're doing some form of Star Wars. But that's partly because of where we are in the fan community. For a lot of people, like, you know, films finish and then they see a trailer for something else and people, and they go, oh, that's great, and I'm gonna get into that, and then they kind of move on to that. It's kind of like this weird, slightly, I don't know, ADHD kind of disposable world that we now live in, I think, for a small portion of people. And don't get me wrong, I'm sure there's people from 99 and even 2015 who are dyed-in-the-wool Star Wars fans, and if there was a hiatus for 5 or 10 years, would stick with it. But what happens is the echo chamber that we live in, and suddenly the people that we follow on Instagram aren't talking about Star Wars. It kind of comes off of your radar a little bit, and then you start to think about it. But then as soon as there's a film announcement, everybody's back on. So I think Star Wars is completely different to all the other franchises in the fact that it seems to be able to weather these lulls, and even maybe this, where we are now, I suppose maybe this, what people say, like, franchise kind of exhaustion and that, where people maybe just a little bit tired of, like, of having to invest all the time in the properties.
Hi, this is Guy Henry, and you're listening to Fantha Tracks. Enjoy.
2024 Oscars, they're not that far away, and ILM had an absolute banner night. Of the 5 films nominated for Best Visual Effects, 4 of them featured visual effects by ILM. The only one that didn't was Godzilla Minus One, an absolutely phenomenal film on every level. So, of course, The Creator was nominated, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning, and Napoleon. So it's looking pretty good for ILM in that visual effects category. You'd like to think it'd pick up a win. Goodness knows, over the last 20 plus years, it's been largely ignored for some reason I cannot fathom. But John Williams as well, nominated for Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, 54th nomination. Phenomenal. Most nominations by anybody alive at the moment. Great news. And what a fantastic score it was.
It really was. I mean, for me, who's not like a hugely well-versed Indiana Jones fan, I'm very much a casual fan. I mean, I did listen to all the soundtracks after I saw Dial of Destiny. I think the next day I was at work, I was like, do you know what? I'm going to stick on the old indie ones. Partly because I was actually working on the Unofficial Science of Indiana Jones. That'll be why I did that. There's definitely some tracks in Dial of Destiny that I was like, this is by far some of the best John Williams stuff. And I tell you what it was, they felt more memorable. And this is the thing, there's maybe one or two, possibly only one or two, and this is not necessarily a slight towards the sequel trilogy, but there's only maybe one or two tracks from that whole trilogy that I could really hum. I would know what they are to listen to them, and I know exactly where they are in the film. They don't have that hook that, like, the leitmotifs did in the original trilogy and even the prequels, but there's something about the Dial of Destiny soundtrack I thought was really cool.
Prequel music, criminally underrated, and how The Phantom Menace didn't win Best Score in 99 completely evades me. That and Empire are the two best Star Wars scores, and Solo. But Solo wasn't nominated because some fool didn't write the format properly, and it wasn't even up for nomination. Insane. That will bug me till my deathbed. But great news for ILM. They've got to stand a fantastic chance. Even though if Godzilla Minus One won an Oscar, I'd be thrilled because it's a phenomenal film. Given all of that, we have a listener's question that kind of links into that John Williams point. And it's from Can't Stop Serenity 97 on Twitter, or X. I guess that's what we're calling it these days. The question is, Who should score future Star Wars films, whether they should have different composers or the same one, and whether or not John Williams can or should be involved. So I'll pick up on that briefly. It felt like John Williams was going to retire. He said Dial of Destiny was his last score. He's now kind of retracted that, because as much as you can have a second wind at 91, whatever wind you get, and I suppose you take it, but he's feeling creative and he wants to carry on. If the rock project comes along, he'll take it. But he did music for Galaxy's Edge. He did the main theme for Solo, which you just mentioned with John Powell. He wrote the main theme for Obi-Wan Kenobi. So he's been involved plenty in modern Star Wars music. But we've got Andor on the go with Nicholas Britell, which was fantastic. We've got Natalie Holt, as we say, just did Kenobi, and Giacchino has done Rogue One, and John Powell has done Solo. So there's other composers, and of course, Ludwig Göransson, who's won awards for his Star Wars music and was nominated again at the Oscars alongside Williams for Oppenheimer. So whilst John Williams is around, whilst we're lucky enough to have him, and I'm going to make the weirdest comparison, which is not a fair comparison whatsoever, but I'm going to make it anyway.
Do it.
You always threw a Stan Lee cameo in a Marvel film because Stan was around, you know, and he's not around anymore. The last one, I believe, was Endgame. So if Stan Lee's around, you can throw a little cameo in a Marvel film. Why wouldn't you? Because it's bloody Stan Lee. And John Williams, the architect of so much amazing music for Lucasfilm, for Star Wars and Indy, and all the Spielberg things that he did. John Williams is around and he wants to pick up that pen and write that music. Why would you not have him involved? That's my feeling. How do you feel about it? Because time moves on, he won't be around forever. It's got to happen at some point.
Unfortunately, it kind of does. If John feels like the creative juices are flowing, and he always seemed to have a bit of a soft spot, the way he spoke about Rey as a character, so whether or not it's Rey or Daisy, don't know, but either or is fine with me. I could be wrong. He might not be writing for Daisy film. It might be Mando and Grogu. He might be writing that, which would be really cool. What better way to bed new characters into the Star Wars language than by having a John Williams written main theme? It's now obviously an overused term to kind of say John Williams is like the oxygen of Star Wars, and many a good podcast has launched because of it. However, it kind of is that. It's like if you ever had the ability to watch a Star Wars film without any Star Wars music, it's a very dry affair. Just as there are other films whereby you can tell when they put the wrong music cue in and it was really destined to have something else. It's clear as day that when somebody doesn't quite understand Star Wars music as writing for Star Wars, it kind of stands out too much.
I wonder, in the same way that Dave Filoni clearly sat under the learning tree of George Lucas, he takes that forward into future Star Wars stuff. And I think we both agree that's a good thing. It doesn't feel in the same way that somebody has sat down with John Williams and taken that forward, because Williams's music is so accessible and so out there. If you're a composer, it's not something you can just, let's do a John Williams, but you kind of get the feel of it. And in the gaming world, there's been some beautiful music. Gordy Harbour's done stuff for Star Wars Squadrons and Republic Commando. Jesse Harlin did some great music, and there's music from Star Wars The Old Republic, and you know, there's all sorts of great stuff out there. And of course, Kevin Kiner with his Clone Wars work and Rebels and Ahsoka. So there's definitely people who grab that feel. And for me personally, John Powell, I mention him all the time, he scored for Solo, he's phenomenal. So it can be done in that sense. But do you think when you listen to certain scores, Mando, for example, Mando to me feels more like a Rocky score than a Star Wars score. And I love that music. So of all the things that really made me think, you know, actually, it doesn't need to sound exactly like John Williams to still feel like Star Wars. Another one is Nicholas Patel's work for Andor works perfectly. So whilst you want to nod to certain themes, you mentioned light motifs and stuff like that. A lot of those things that Williams did were specific to characters. And sometimes you throw in a little musical cue from a Star Wars film. Doesn't work because it's not for the character it was meant for. Whereas Indiana Jones, going back to Dial of Destiny, they're throwing in stuff from Raiders, they're throwing in stuff from Last Crusade. Hey, it's all indie. It's about that guy. So it works. You're referring to a moment or an action beat or something that he did. You can do that with indie. It's different with Star Wars. Do you think that we can or should retain that Williams feel as much as you can? Or are you prepared, once you get past the opening theme, which in my opinion, the main Star Wars theme should never change, you know, are you happy for them to try different things?
It's very difficult because, like, if you were to now take Ludwig Göransson's music out of Mando and you were to put in something different, you'd be like, it's not the same, it's not as good. And part of it's just down to what we get used to listening to. I kind of think that in some respects, if you were to suddenly do a completely different version of a Star Wars theme for an opening scroll, that's not going to work. But then there's no reason why it can't then blend into a different style of music because the rest of the film is a slightly different feel and tone in that. Because ultimately, that's what it needs to do. The music needs to kind of reinforce what we're seeing rather than work against the pictures. It's got to work in harmony.
There'll come a time when John Williams isn't around and new fans will come in, which you'd like to think happens all the time. Every episode, every comic, potentially, there's an avenue, there's an opening for a new fan to come on board. And they will not have lived in a time where new John Williams music is important and means something to Star Wars fans. When you get to that point, in the same way that a lot of kids now will look at Doug Chang's work as their primary Star Wars designer rather than Ralph McQuarrie, which almost sounds sacrilegious to say, but if you came in as a prequel kid and came through as a sequel kid rather than an OT, that's what will attract their eye. Do you think there'll be a time when other composers, or even like Have I Got News For You, as a different presenter every week, it's a different person doing the music for every project, and that's just how it is?
I think if not an actual nostalgic love for John Williams, I think there will always be that recognition of what he has done for the franchise and for the films. But yeah, I mean, who's not to say that the next person who does score Mando and Grogu, if it isn't John, completely blows it out of the water in a completely different way. And then for that series, you kind of go, John Williams' music would not have worked for whatever reason. You know, there's also that possibility. It's a very specific style. It's a very specific style that at the time wasn't really being used in cinema. And that's one reason why George brought it back, was because then it kind of gave it a timeless passion about it. You listen to scores over the years as like an evolution, and the style of cinema scores changes and things come in and out of vogue and stuff. So the difference is that, like, I think when you listen to John Williams' score, it does feel timeless. And it'll be interesting to go back to Mando season one score in say 5 or 10 years time and decide whether or not it does feel timeless, or does it somehow slightly feel dated because it's kind of has got that slightly more edgy rockiness about it.
The thing with Star Wars is it's become its own thing. Like we said earlier, Star Wars is its own world, it's its own vibe and style, but it's also very, and rightfully, very self-referential. Do you think sometimes that Star Wars music needs to not be that, because you do evoke, as a Star Wars fan, you kind of want the vibe of this or the feel of that to remind you of this or make you think about that? Do you think there'll be a point where Star Wars gets beyond that self-referential point and tries to do something different? Or will that mean it's just not Star Wars anymore, and that makes the music of John Williams so bloody important because it doesn't work without that feel?
It's difficult, isn't it? I mean, I suppose it's almost like the question I think we posed at the very first ever recording of any Star Wars podcast, and that is, what is Star Wars? How do you know what is good Star Wars to bad Star Wars? And it kind of comes down to a personal kind of objective. It's slightly different from one person to another. A Bad Batch fan isn't necessarily going to have the same kind of feels and vibes for VOT as they do for animated characters on a screen. And so they will have a different perspective as to what Star Wars kind of is. So you know it when you hear it.
If you want to be part of the action, visit FanthaTracks.com, or be sure to comment, like and share on our social media feeds at FanthaTracks. Send in your listeners' questions by emailing radio@FanthaTracks.com. Subscribe, leave a review, preferably a 5-star one, on Amazon Music, Audible, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher or smart speaker of choice. And as always, thanks to James Temple for composing the FanthaTracks intro, Adam O'Brien for our making tracks opening music, and Mark Daniel and Vanessa Marshall for our voiceovers. Tune in to Good Morning Tatooine. It's live Sunday evenings, 9 o'clock UK, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, on Facebook, YouTube and Twitch. And check out our FanthaTracks Radio Friday night rotation every Friday at 7 o'clock UK time for new episodes of The Phantom from Down Under, Planet Layer, Desert Planet Discs, Start Your Engines, Collecting Tracks, Cannon Fodder, and special episodes of Making Tracks. And every Tuesday at 7 o'clock UK time for your weekly episode of Making Tracks. And remember, FanthaTracks.com, our social media feeds, FanthaTracks TV and FanthaTracks Radio are absolutely free. So no Patreon, Buy Me A Coffee, Kickstarter or Indiegogo required to stay updated on all the latest Star Wars news.
Awesome. Okay, thank you very much for that, buddy. Appreciate that. And you take care and have a good week. I will catch you next week's episode. And to everybody else, thank you very much for listening. stay safe, take care, and of course, may the Force be with you.
Coming up next on Fantha Tracks Radio, it's another episode of Making Tracks.
God, I wish we had a different presenter every week.